The views expressed on the Final Straw Radio do not necessarily reflect those of Asheville FM, WSFM LP Asheville, or Friends of Community Radio. 103.3 Asheville FM is currently running an Indiegogo campaign through Monday, the 15th of May, 2015. The campaign can be found on ashevillefm.org by clicking the Tune In and Turn It Up button, where you can make your tax-deductible donation to this newly terrestrial radio station. Also, check out the website to see a wide variety of locally produced programming. If you want to get involved, click the Volunteer tab at the top of the page, or oprima las palabras, únase a AFM para voluntar. You're listening to Asheville FM at WSFM LP 103.3 Asheville. Also online at ashevillefreemedia.org. This is The Final Straw, and I'm Bursa Goodness. The show can also be heard on KXCF in Marshall, California, KWTF in Bodega Bay, California, KOWA LP in Olympia, Washington, and WCRS LP in Columbus, Ohio. Archives of the show can be found a week after broadcast at thefinalstrawradio.noblogs.org, and you can reach us for queries or comments or whatever at thefinalstrawradio@riseup.net. This week we've got three segments for y'all. Right after the regular commentary by Sean Swain, you'll hear one of Sean's support folks, Ben Turk, talk about updates on Sean's situation. It's good news for once. After that, we bring you Jenny from Sacramento Prisoner Support to talk about the June 11th Day of Solidarity with long-term anarchist and eco-prisoners. In this last segment, you'll hear a member of the Incarcerated Workers Organizing Committee based out of Kansas City talking about recent problems at prisons in the state of Missouri. On a note, in terms of the June 11th conversation, if you're in the Asheville area, here are a few events for June 11th, 2015. Firstly, at Downtown Books and News, 67 North Lexington Avenue, Asheville, there will be an open house for Transmission Prison Project and Asheville Prison Book Project. At 3:30, you can join volunteers for an intro to these Books to Prisoners projects, conversations about incarceration, and help to pack up some books for prisoners. Afterwards, there will be a brief presentation on the history of the Anarchist Black Cross. Later that evening, there will, at the soon-to-be-opened Firestorm Books and Cafe, 610 Haywood Road in West Asheville, there will be a showing of the film Long Distance Revolutionary about the life and struggle of Mumia Abu-Jamal, as well as updates about his case and his medical maltreatment by authorities. Finally, on Saturday, June 13th, at the auditorium at 1045 Haywood Road in West Asheville, again, there's a sliding scale dance party and pie auction beginning at 9 p.m. Proceeds will go to the prisoners who are being supported by the June 11th organizing. To see a partial list of participating cities and maybe plug into an event near you, check out June11.org. Also of note, there will be a protest at 6 p.m. Eastern Time in front of the Durham County offices at 200 East Main Street in Durham, North Carolina. Following the protest, there will be a county budgetary meeting that people are being asked to attend to voice protest against the lockback at the county jail in Durham. The lockback has been a withdrawal of hours outside of cells among the prisoners in that jail by the Sheriff's Department. Currently, inmates can only leave their cells for 2 hours a week, which, as one advocate of the prisoners has stated, is enough time to take a shower and maybe make a phone call at 2 a.m. Next week, we'll be speaking about the situation at the Durham County Jail with the lockback with a member of the Inside Outside Alliance and a relative of someone incarcerated there. More info on the struggle against it and words by those incarcerated there can be found at amplifyvoices.com, the website of the Inside Outside Alliance. What you say, what you say, what you say,
what? Record like a bomb! Let's talk about political violence. In 2013, ODRG Counsel Trevor Clark told me that Americans are not permitted to advocate violence. More recently, a federal judge said we are only allowed to advocate political change through peaceful means. I'm assuming that peaceful equates with nonviolence. All of this indicates that poor, deluded hierarchies believe that political violence is not legitimate. So, what exactly is political violence? According to my dictionary, violence is the exertion of force to cause harm or injury. That's the violence half of the political. My dictionary defines political as of relating to the affairs of government. So that's the political half. We put that together, and I think we have a decent working definition of political violence. The exertion of force to cause harm or injury of or relating to the affairs of government. So there we have it. Poor, deluded hierarchies keep telling me that the crux of the problem is my belief in political violence. my belief in the exertion of force to cause harm or injury of or relating to the affairs of government. And I'm not quite sure what hierarchs mean by that. If by believing in political violence, they mean I believe it is real and it exists, I would say that I know political violence is real. This is undisputed. To not believe that political violence is real is like...
This call is originating from an Ohio correctional facility and may be recorded and monitored.
I believe in gravity. I believe political violence is real. If believing in political violence, hierarchs mean I believe political violence works. I know it does. So do the sociologists who write textbooks that demonstrate how politically violent movements gain demands or concessions more often and have far greater success than nonviolent movements do. That's a fact. So we're back to believing in gravity and political violence. If by believing in political violence, hierarchs mean I think political violence is a legitimate means of struggle, I do believe in political violence. But the fact of the matter is, every poor, deluded hierarch who recognizes the legitimacy of the United States of America also believes in political violence, and I can prove it. The United States of America gained recognition of its independence from Great Britain in the Treaty of Paris in 1787. In that treaty, Britain ceded the 13 colonies and the rights of discovery related to all lands west of the Allegheny Mountains. In essence, Britain recognized the United States as an independent, sovereign nation. At the Treaty of Paris, Britain ceded that independence to a group of famous dead guys who were termed the Founding Fathers of the United States. In reality, these so-called Founding Fathers were cop killers and terrorists. Not only were they cop killers and terrorists, but they were good at it. Consider how those cop killers and terrorists gained their independence from Britain. George Washington led a rebel army outnumbered by the legitimate, recognized government forces, so they engaged in guerrilla warfare, shooting the redcoats in the back. I'm not attributing any value judgment to that. Whether shooting redcoats in the back was right or wrong, I'm simply pointing that out that that's what they did. So, at the Treaty of Paris, the legitimate government of the 13 colonies, Great Britain, sat across the table from cop killers. But there were also terrorists present on the American side. Consider what is now referred to as the Boston Tea Party, a contingent of American colonial rebels in secret, dressed up as Native Americans to disguise themselves. Then they raided British government ships. Those violent rebels overwhelmed the government's guards, tossed the government's tea into the harbor, and burned the boats into the sea. Pound for pound, this so-called Boston Tea Party was the most devastating act of economic terrorism on U.S. soil in history, until the attacks on 9/11. That means the world didn't produce more effective terrorists than Alexander Hamilton, Thomas Jefferson, or Ben Franklin, you know. The slave owners whose fates are on your money, until Osama bin Laden came along more than two centuries later. By that standard, Osama bin Laden should soon appear on American money or have his face carved into the side of a mountain. So, if you recognize the legitimacy of the United States of America, as most deluded hierarchs do, then you recognize as legitimate the political violence undertaken by the cop killers and terrorists who sat across from the British government at the signing of the Treaty of Paris in 1787. And that means poor, deluded hierarchs, whether they like it or not, are in perfect agreement with the political violence is real, effective, and legitimate. We only differ, perhaps, in the question of when to employ it, and against whom. But since Ohio prison administrators are totally inept at shutting me down, I should have plenty of time to persuade others to my way of thinking. This is the anarchist prisoner Sean Swain from somewhere inside the American torture complex. If you're listening, you are the resistance.
You can write to Sean Swain at his new address at seanswain243-205. P.O. Box 45699, 1724 State Route, number 728, Lucasville, Ohio, 45699. To read some of Sean's writings and learn more about his case, check out seanswain.org. I'm joined by the indefatigable Ben Turk. Ben's offered to update us on Sean Swain's current situation. Thanks a lot for coming on, Ben.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So can you give some background briefly into who Sean Swain is and what's been going on with him since his transfer to Lucasville?
Sure. Sean Swain is an anarchist prisoner held in prison in Ohio. He was incarcerated for murder, serving a life sentence and parole. The situation was his girlfriend's ex kicked down his door and had been threatening to kill him, and he defended himself, and the girlfriend's ex, who was abusive, ended up dead. And unfortunately, his aunt was the clerk of courts, and so Sean got railroaded, and he has been fighting for his freedom ever since, and becoming increasingly radical over the years. He's been down for over 20 years now. And so now, at this point, he's just always writing and putting out information and has a segment on The Final Straw and various other ways that he gets his voice out there and gets his criticism of not only the prison system and not only his case, but capitalism and hierarchy in general.
And what's been going on since he was recently transferred to SOCF Lucasville?
Yeah, so he was at the Supermax, and they moved a lot of prisoners around at the Supermax recently as part of a new tiered system that they're using to try to isolate troublemakers more effectively. And so Sean, as well as all the other 4A prisoners, got moved down to Lucasville, which is a mostly level 4 prison. And there are some officials at the ODRC who want to shut Sean up. And they've been doing everything they can to try to shut him up and give him hell and trouble for the last few years. And so they took away his access to email and telephone. And then some of his friends on the range started emailing his supporters and people on the outside to, you know, just let us know that Sean's all right and what's going on with his situation and stuff like that. They also canceled my ability to visit Sean or any of the prisoners I work with in Ohio. And I don't live in Ohio, so that was really inconvenient because I was planning to go and visit. And now the main reason for going to visit was taken away. And so that's frustrating. But anyway, they just keep kind of closing him down and isolating him. The most recent news, as of yesterday, we heard that they had confiscated the email sending devices. So how the ODRC does this is they have a contract with a company called JPay that gives people like the prison equivalent of iPads. There are these little devices where you can type and write your own emails up or listen to music or play video games or otherwise, you know, distract and pacify yourself. And also if any communication that you have has been keyword searchable, but it's more convenient and easier, so a lot of prisoners use them. And it's been the main way that Sean's been keeping in touch with me and other people on the outside. His was taken away months ago, but now other guys on the block are having theirs taken away as well because they're letting us know where Sean is at. So we got a message that this was going on, phone number to have a bunch of people call to try to get people their MP, their little JP4 devices back. And then got a call before we could actually put that out to the general public. And it was from one of the guys on the block who was calling to find out about Sean's dad, actually. Sean's dad has just had back surgery. And Sean was wondering how his dad was doing. And since the prison has been restricting all of his mail, anything that even goes through snail mail gets circulated from the mail room to somewhere in central office where they take forever to read it and get it to Sean. So he asked somebody to call out to try to get a hold of his dad. So I checked in, got his mom on the phone, and she was able to say that his dad is doing all right. And we also found out that the guys got their MP3, their JP4 players back, and that Sean is going to be transferred to level 3. So that's a security level reduction.
With one being the lowest?
Yeah, one is minimum security, 2 and 3 are medium. There's minimum, medium, close, maximum, and supermax is how the Ohio system works. So it's confusing and contradictory. There are people who are saying he can't have visitors, he can't have access to any of this communication because he is a unique security threat. And then, meanwhile, there's somebody else in the ODRC who's like, he hasn't had a real ticket for years. There's no reason he should be on level 4. We're going to transfer him down to level 3 and also get him out of the prison that he is currently in. And so maybe the warden at SOCF is just, like, sick of having to deal with having a prisoner who stands up for himself and has outside support. And so he's trying to pass Sean off to a different warden. Or maybe the warden at SOCF is like, what is all this bullshit? I'm going to get him out of here. I'm sure we'll hear from Sean eventually somehow what his take is on these decisions and why this happened. But overall, good news. Sean will be out of solitary confinement once this transfer goes through.
How long has he been in solitary?
A few years now. So all of this started, the biggest wave of repression started with his criticism of actually JPay, because JPay took over inmate accounts, and rather than sending your information to, rather than sending money directly to the commissary accounts for prisoners, you now send it to this private corporation who handles it, charges a surcharge, and gets it to the prisoners. And when the state set this up, they gave all the visitor information of all the prisoners to this private company. Sean wrote an angry letter about, you know, privatization and sharing of private information. And after that, a lot of things happened, and that happened at the same time as, like, a group called the Army of the 12 Monkeys started a sabotage campaign at the prison. And so the prison authorities are like, the guy who wrote this angry article and this organization must be linked. Sean must be the leader of the Army of the 12 Monkeys. And first they threw him in the hole for about a year and a half. So he was in the hole at Mansfield Correctional, and there they were straight up torturing him. Like, he and the other guys who were accused of leading the Army of the 12 Monkeys were, like, given starvation rations and denied all kinds of access to anything, and having, like, toilet water spilled down on them because they put them in a cell with holes in the plumbing, and just, yeah, lots of really terrible stuff. And eventually the prison got sick of him fighting back against that kind of stuff and sent him up to OSP, which is the Supermax. He spent, I think, a year and a half there as well, which is a much more clean and sanitary and, like, orderly form of solitary confinement. It's a very sterile place, but people at Central Office were still messing with Sean's access to any kind of outside communication, and so he kept fighting there. Then he got moved down to SOCF, which is a much older prison, much dirtier, much more racist, Southern Ohio. Sean's a white guy, but he witnessed all kinds of racism there and talked about it, and then got in trouble for standing up and you know, using the contacts he has on the outside to raise awareness about racist repression and crazy shit going on there. Yeah, so it's been probably 3-4 years that he's been in some form of solitary confinement.
Give the guy a break. God.
Yeah, I know.
At least they're getting tired of killing him.
Right, yeah, that's what it seems like. That's what he always says. He always says, they'll get tired of killing me before I get tired of dying.
Besides blocking visitation for you to Sean and other prisoners in Ohio, SeanSwain.org references harassment of his supporters on the outside, namely you again and also Ihsan. Can you talk more about that?
So Ihsan is a friend of Sean's. She got to know him well, all of this was going on, and became very close supporter of him. She also has had a lot of, like, personal troubles and difficulties herself, and I don't know why. She went up to visit him, and so she drove all the way from Texas to visit him, and then, like, after she got back home, got the same letter that I got saying that she's banned and what is the phrase that they use, that we are helping distribute security threats? Well, they take anything that Sean says as a threat. And so by helping to distribute or get his voice out in the world, apparently that means that we're helping to distribute security threats. So, yeah, she got that letter, and I was frustrated by getting that letter, but she is somebody who's more likely to be, like, scared and confused about getting a threatening letter from state authorities. So that was pretty upsetting. I had to talk with her about, you know, that they're just trying to scare us, that this is a bunch of bull. And, yeah, but it's, I don't know. There are a lot of, you know, Sean is not just an anarchist firebrand who is just constantly churning out militant propaganda. He also has, you know, friendships and family members. His parents are retired auto workers, and his dad just got back surgery, and they're having a hard time and really like to have their son in their lives. And the prison authorities are preventing that only because Sean stands up for himself.
Well, it's great that he's been moved down to level three. What can folks on the outside do to keep up on the case and keep up on what Sean's up to?
Yeah, as soon as we get an update from Sean describing what's actually going on with more information, that'll get posted to SeanSwain.org. You can also sign up for the email list through links on that site and donate to just kind of help with his legal fees. We found a pro bono lawyer, but legal fees help us to pay for filing fees and stuff like that in any litigation that Sean has going on, trying to, you know, he tries to fight these things from every angle that he possibly can, and that includes the courts, which can be expensive.
Thanks so much for coming on, Ben. It's always a pleasure talking to you.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
You're listening to The Final Straw on Asheville FM at WSFM LP 103.3 Asheville, out of Asheville, North Carolina. We're speaking with Jenny from Sacramento Prisoner Support. Thanks for coming onto the show again, buddy.
Thanks for having me, buddy.
So June 11th is just around the corner. Can you tell listeners about the history of June 11th?
Sure. So June 11th actually began in the early 2000s as a day of solidarity for then eco prisoner Jeff Lures. Jeff was serving a really outrageous 22-year prison sentence for an arson at a car dealership in Eugene, Oregon. Thankfully, he won an appeal of his sentence and was released in December of 2009 after serving about 10 years in prison. Unfortunately, though, during that time, Jeff was fighting and winning his appeal. Marius and Eric were both arrested and sentenced to similarly outrageous prison terms. For Eric, it ended up being about 20 years and 22 for Marius. In 2010-ish, people who were working on support for both Eric and Marius got together kind of in an effort to figure out how to better organize what we knew was going to have to be long-term support for both of them. So the way that June 11th had worked for Jeff really was an inspiration to us and was obviously a success given his early release. So with agreement from folks who were previously involved in June 11th organizing, it was decided that we should renew that tradition for Marius and Eric, and that's what we've done.
So this year we've had a number of success stories in the United States. Eric McDavid is free, for instance.
Hooray!
Can you talk about shifts in the way that June 11th is being pushed for by organizers?
Sure. So like you mentioned, we had a couple of really positive things happen in the last year, which we felt warranted some kind of recognition. You know, it's a very rare thing for us to be able to talk about success when we're talking about prison. And we want to be able to celebrate those successes while, of course, recognizing that our struggle against prisons is never over until all are free. So the call out for June 11th this year talks a lot about transition. The transition for Eric, obviously being from a life on the inside to a life outside, and the transition for Marius being that he recently came out publicly as a man. So Eric is now out in the world with us again. I honestly didn't believe that I would ever be able to say that until his projected release date, so that's super exciting.
Hooray!
Yay! When I say it out loud, I still almost can't really believe it's true, but if that's not worth celebrating, I don't know what is. So we're definitely celebrating that this year. And of course, Marius coming out publicly is also cause for celebration. But we also want to recognize that while these are both incredibly positive developments, both Marius and Eric still obviously need support. In some ways, perhaps now more than ever, the transition from prison to the world outside can be super intense, physically, emotionally, and materially. The support that Eric has received in all of those ways since his release has been really incredible. J11 will probably be the last big public push for material support for him, so let's make it count, everyone. So while we're thrilled to celebrate Eric's release, we also need to make sure that we don't forget that our comrade Marius is still inside, and he will need our continued love and support. Transitioning outside of prison is obviously really complicated and challenging, but doing so from inside of prison is infinitely more so. Several other prisoners were mentioned in the call out this year. And, you know, J11 is, at least in my mind, primarily a day of solidarity for Marius and Eric, of course. But again, hopefully this will be the last year. But it does put us in a position to call attention to broader prisoner struggles and to individual ego and anarchist prisoners, both nationally and internationally. So, you know, J11 has always, at its heart, been a call for solidarity with all imprisoned comrades, and we want that call to benefit as many prisoners as possible while simultaneously acting as a day for Marius and Eric as two people that we have very real personal connections with. So that was one of the things that we were trying to do with the call out this year, talking about transitions, but also sort of broadening the language and the call out to include folks involved in other prison struggles.
For anyone in the listening audience who isn't aware of Marius Mason's case, could you briefly go over like what he was convicted of?
Sure. So Marius was arrested in the late 2000s, I want to say 2008, for a series of actions that were claimed by the Earth Liberation Front. And he ultimately pled guilty to two or three of those actions, including burning logging equipment and a couple of other things related to that action specifically. However, in his plea agreement, Marius had to admit involvement in, I believe, 13 other actions. So technically he was convicted of two, but then admitted to several other actions. And at his sentencing, the prosecution really went after him and talked about his support network, talked about his politics, and really tried to use all of those things against him. Unfortunately, it seems like that worked with the judge, and Marius was sentenced to 22 years in prison, which is a really outrageous sentence. You know, a lot of people who are convicted of things like arson or rape or even murder are sentenced to way less time than that. And Marius' sentence is, as far as we know, the longest standing sentence of any environmental prisoner in the United States.
Yeah, it's incredible. Outside of Marius, who are some of the other prisoners y'all mentioned, and what criteria do you use to determine who's long-term and who's not?
We mentioned several other folks this year, just a few of them. Sean Swain is definitely mentioned. He is an anarchist prisoner in a supermax facility in Ohio. He's very prolific, and I'm sure folks who listen to your show are probably familiar with him. Michael Kimball is a Black gay anarchist prisoner in Alabama, who is also part of the incredibly inspirational Free Alabama movement. Chelsea Manning is mentioned. Hopefully folks know about Chelsea. And Chelsea has also had several successes of her own around hormones and gender transitioning within prison in the last year. I don't know that he is mentioned in the call out, but Bill Dunn is also listed on our prisoner page this year. Bill is a longtime anarchist prisoner who is in for attempted liberations from prison, both his own and others. One interesting tidbit about Bill is that he recently came up for parole and was given a 15-year hit, which means he won't be eligible again for another 15 years. And one of the main reasons that the state gave for denying his parole was that he still associates with anarchists, which is interesting slash terrible. Bill is actually serving an 80-year sentence and has been in, I believe, since 1979. You can read about a lot of those folks on the J11 page, and folks should certainly check that out.
And what's the website for that?
It's just june11.org. And as far as the focus on long-term prisoners, you know, the reason that we do that is that when we originally got together in 2010 to talk about Marius and Eric, that was really the main problem that we were trying to solve, was how to sort of structure support for them in a way that would make it sustainable over the long term. And June 11th really seemed like a good way to keep Eric and Marius on people's minds. You know, it's this annual event that happens every year. It kind of reminds people that they're still here, still struggling, and obviously still needing support. You know, people who are in long term obviously have a lot of the same needs as people who are in for shorter terms, but they also have some different needs. And where those needs overlap, there's also have to be sustained for much longer, which of course presents problems of its own. So raising thousands of dollars, for example, for a trial lawyer is one thing. It feels, you know, obviously urgent and necessary and usually can happen kind of quickly if it needs to. But then how do we keep people actively involved and interested in someone's case and in their needs, both financial and emotional, for 20 years? And those are the kind of questions we were struggling with. And J11 was just one of the answers that we came up with. You know, it seems like a lot of folks who are getting sentenced for actions in this country often get anywhere from like 0 to 10 years. Marius and Eric's cases were both examples of that going terribly wrong. And, you know, they both got 20 plus years. 10 years is kind of what we've been using. as the designation for long term, but, you know, there's definitely leeway there, and we definitely don't want people to think that, you know, anything less than 10 years is something to laugh at. Even a day in prison is way too long in our minds. This was mostly just an effort to recognize that people who are in for extended periods of time have different needs, and this was a way to try to address that.
So the date is June 11th is actually about a week away from when we're talking right now. It's approaching very fast. For folks who are hearing this, what can they do to find out more about the date? Well, you've already mentioned the website, but also to get ideas about how to organize for it.
So yeah, definitely check out the website. There used to be a list on there of actions and stuff that's happened in the past. I'm not sure it's still there. If it's not, I'll try to make sure it goes back up. But that's always a great place to start. You know, you can always email the June 11th email, which is just June 11th with a TH at the end, at riseup.net. If you want sort of more ideas or thoughts about how to go about doing that. You know, I think it's also cool to kind of check out what folks have done in years past. It always gets a little jumbled in my head, but some of the things that I remember from years past that I thought were a little more spectacular and exciting. Israel actually always does really amazing stuff. One year they had a drag show, which I thought was great. They almost always take pictures of people at their events holding up signs that say things like, I support Marius or I support Eric. And then they send those pictures to Marius and Eric and send them to their support crews. And that's always really fun and exciting to see. New York City does punk rock karaoke, which I always think sounds really fun. People have dance parties, obviously shows, bake sales. People do noise demos at jails and marches, just about everything that you could imagine. And, you know, I think the point is just to keep Marius and Eric alive in people's minds and to show them real solidarity and support in whatever way you and your community sees fit.
So when folks raise money for J11, where does the money go?
For Eric in the past, all of that money has gone directly into his support fund. Often that money was used to fund visits for him. Sometimes it was used for legal costs and, you know, for everyday needs, things like commissary or books. This year, that money is going to go to his post-release needs, which is super exciting. As I'm sure you can imagine, getting out of prison after 9 years isn't exactly cheap. He is basically starting from scratch. You know, he had no phone, no car, hardly any clothes, no driver's license. You know, he didn't have anything. And so he's really just kind of building his life in a material sense. Eventually, he's going to want to move into his own place. You know, right now, he's just living with his family. And of course, that's all going to be super expensive. So money raised this year will go directly to helping him get back on his feet financially. June 11th has always been the main source of funds for Eric's support. And I really don't know what he would have done without it and what we as his family and friends would have done without it. It's really been a lifesaver. I can't speak to exactly how the money is used for Marius, but I'm guessing it's used in similar ways. And I know the feedback that I've always heard from Marius's support crews is really positive. And I think that that money goes a very long way to helping Marius meet all of his needs in prison every year.
One thing I recall from past conversations about June 11th and about Marius's case and fundraising for him, and also it's represented on one of these really cute postcards for this year's J11.
Those are really cute.
Yeah. I looked at it and I'm like, fired to the prisons. Oh my gosh, that's such a funny joke. but is raising money for his aging cats, who he cares about very, very dearly, who have like medical problems and things. I think that's pretty important. And you know, Marius has, I think, two kids that are on the outside. And I don't know, whatever the relationship is, I'm sure that there's funding that needs to go to help take care of them since he can't work a job that he's going to make more than a few cents an hour at.
Yeah, Marius's position is super untenable. He's in a really terrible facility in Carswell, Texas. It's super restrictive. He almost never gets out of his cell. You know, he almost never gets to go outside. He doesn't get visitors all that often. They're on lockdown pretty constantly. It's a pretty awful place to be. Even for prisons are always awful, but even within that, it's an even more awful place to be. And because he's in Texas, he is thousands of miles away from a lot of the people that he really loves and cares about. And so money raised during June 11th certainly could help get him visits and get him those connections that he really needs to help stay sane, you know, in such a terrible, awful place.
If someone doesn't have the wherewithal or like a community around them that they can organize in, what kind of impact does, say, writing a letter have on long-term prisoners, whether they be anarchist or non-anarchist?
You know, I think letters have a huge impact, and I think they're often really undervalued. You know, it's really easy to tell people to write a letter. I think people write that off as insignificant or not worth their time. They want to feel like they're doing something more important or more impactful. But honestly, what I have heard repeatedly from prisoners is that people who write them, and I don't just mean, you know, sending a birthday card now and then or a postcard, and those things are nice, and definitely people should be doing that too. But what prisoners really love and need is somebody who can commit to a real relationship with them that lasts over the years that they are in prison. Really commit and don't overcommit. You know, don't say you're going to write to 12 people. Pick one or two people that you feel like you have a real connection with and stay in touch with those people and learn about their lives and what they need and what makes them happy and just really be there for them, because it's really hard for folks who feel like they have lost connections to their communities, to their movements, to the struggles that they were a part of. And if somebody who is also involved in those same movements and struggles can be in touch with them and share with them what's happening on the outside and share with them what's happening in their own lives, it's very important and super impactful. And really, I think for a prisoner, probably the most important thing. I've definitely heard that from Eric. I've definitely heard that from other people that I write to. I really can't stress enough how important that is.
So I've heard that there's some fancy swag for organizing and expanding conversations on the June 11th date. Is there any way for folks to get a hold of that?
Yes, there are shirts and stickers in the works. If you're interested in receiving some of them, you can contact folks. The email address that you should be using for that is uncontrollableandfree@gmail.com. So yeah, folks at that address can help you figure out pricing. They can help you figure out what kind of designs they have. Really encourage people to check that out. And then, of course, on the website, if you click on resources, there's all sorts of zines and posters, especially for Marius this year. Some folks made some new exciting posters. So definitely check that out as well.
Well, thanks so much, Jenny. Is there anything else that you wanted to mention?
Thanks for having me. And I guess I will just say that June 11th has been really pivotal, like I said before, for Eric's support, definitely for his fundraising campaigns. But, you know, more than that, I think it has been a very effective tool for keeping people engaged and excited and interested in Eric and his case and the importance of all of those things. And I guess I just want to say thanks to everybody who has participated in it over the years and hopefully who will continue to participate in it for Marius and all the other folks who need our support right now. But it really has been a lifesaver, and thanks y'all for keeping it going.
Well, thanks for all the work that you do.
Thanks, Burst. Thanks for having me.
You're listening to The Final Straw on Asheville FM at WSFM LP 103.3 Asheville, out of Asheville, North Carolina. We're speaking with Brianna Perrell of the IWOC, or the Incarcerated Workers Organizing Committee, and Tommy Powell from the Missouri Innocence Project. Thanks a lot for chatting.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you.
Can you all tell us about what's going on at the Southeast Correctional Center, or SECC, near Charleston, Missouri?
We have a Letters to Prisoners program going, and an organizing project. And we've received letters from prisoners almost out of every facility in Missouri. And I've noticed lately at SECC, we've been receiving less letters and less complaints. And then the other day, we got a letter that says the prisoners who are rebellious or who don't go along with the program of abuse are being misdiagnosed with mental illness and then being medicated into submission. And I'm not entirely sure, but I suspect this may be why we've been receiving less letters from our friends inside there. And so we've started a call-in campaign and asking people around the country and the world to call and email and write to the prison and to the Inspector General of Missouri to try and find out exactly what's going on in that facility. I can add a little bit more. Some of the common complaints that we would receive would include, like, cleanliness. One of the things that really surprised me when I started doing this kind of work was that so many people wanted cleaning supplies. They weren't asking somebody to clean up after them, but just to have cleaning supplies so they could clean up after their own selves. And so it's those kind of conditions that we would receive complaints about that we're not receiving anymore. Tommy, can you talk more about the conditions at the Missouri prisons in general?
Well, it depends on what aspect of the punishment or, you know, somewhat what you would call abusive tactics, which aspect you want to inquire about. But with respect to the administration of psychoactive drugs, that's taking place in these prisons across Missouri, and they're spreading it. What's happening primarily is they're getting doctors that are underqualified, that, you know, basically are veterinarians, just got some letters behind their names, and being employed sometimes by the CCA commission, whatever this business is that contracts medical services with the Missouri Department of Corrections. And you get these types of people, and they target the inmates that don't like to be abused for whatever reason, or they will assert themselves for whatever reason, and then they'll force this medication upon them and change the whole nature and character of the brain of these people and basically make them crazy when they didn't start off that way.
And what sort of, what if they were to take the complaint of a prisoner, these administrators and these guards and whatever, what sort of process is this avoiding them going through to actually address the concerns of the prisoner?
Well, things like the way the guards basically treat you, everything comes down to the way you're being treated. Somebody may not call you a somebody may not call you a somebody may not call you a certain name, then they'll treat you a certain way. They'll come in, you might have your clothes and stuff, you know, situated a certain way. They'll come in, throw your stuff all over the floor, just dog it out, call you, just grab you, throw you up against the wall, mistreat all your stuff, put you in the hole for, just because they don't like your attitude. Because you may ask the administration, hey, look, you know, is it possible that we be allowed to keep our food in our containers for a certain period of time without the guards coming in, throwing it over the cell just because they're in the mood to do it on this particular day. You know, I mean, to ask what specifically the concerns are is almost I can't really address, because the concerns are multiple and all the time. You're just the type of individual that shows a spark of resistance in any type of way, against anything that any capricious or arbitrary rule that they come out with today or tomorrow, which happens all the time. I mean, I don't want to seem like the type of person that just rails against the Department of Corrections, but the medical situation, especially with regard to those who have been placed under forced psychotropic administration of drugs, those individuals, and the characters of those individuals being phased out by prison administrators through their psychologists, just trying to break the will and the overall drive of these prisoners.
I guess more my question was, what redress methods are actually in place that the guards and administrators are avoiding by declaring that prisoners are mentally unhealthy and then forcibly drugging them? But
that's the trick right there. First, they get the psychiatrist to say that the person is imbalanced. Then they apply for the court order. And the courts, usually within these counties that they put these prisons in, the counties are so glad to get the prisons because it puts a boost in the economic security of those counties way out in these rural areas. And so the judges are just basic rubber stamps. So you're supposed to go through a judicial process where the psychiatrist presents his findings to the judge, and then the judge will assign the order. But what happens is you got a rubber stamp process with these county judges that are probably sitting in somebody's bathtub somewhere and come out and be the judge for a minute and go back in. I'm being sarcastic, but yeah, that's the process that, you know, supposed to safeguard or the due process protection that prisoners have in prison to keep from being arbitrarily or capriciously assigned these medications.
And also, the effects of what's happening is now the administration can disregard any kind of grievances that the people have. They can say, oh, well, this person has a mental illness, and they're hallucinating, or they're, you know, not stable enough to be able to complain through official channels about the conditions. But even more than that, the people are rendered unable to work together collectively to improve their conditions. We've gotten reports that some of the medications that they're putting people on affect their vision, so they can't even read their mail, much less write outgoing letters. So it really completely effectively silences those people. And like I said, we used to get letters, even collective letters. SECC was organizing fairly well. We got a letter early on from 22 prisoners had signed off on a collective letter complaining about the conditions, and I've not heard from them again. So whatever efforts they have at improving their conditions together are rendered completely ineffective by these medications that they're being put on.
Is there a new warden or any sort of new administration in power that would have applied this methodology, or is just...
Well, you get guys, these captains and these lieutenants that are working in these prisons, and these majors and these administrators in general, you know, from the top down. I have to give them credit. You know, they study deeply on how to control an inmate population. I hate to use that word, but how to control prisoners. And so... It's like they study the same way a coach would study how to, you know, overcome the opposing team. They sit down and they think about, okay, which prisoners are the strongest? Which prisoners, you know, exhibit this type of mental aptitude? You know, or which prisoner, when they walk past me, I feel a certain vibe from her, or will look me in the eye for too long, or just won't allow me to just stop them arbitrarily and talk to them like they're, you know, a piece of garbage sitting on truth somewhere. You know, what prisoner gives me this indication? What prisoner leads too many people? Too many people are listened to. How many prisoners, you know, speaking one voice behind this other person? Then they'll target those individuals, put them in certain spots. Once they get them there, then they'll go to divide and conquer. Lie, say one prisoner might have snitched on another prisoner when it really didn't happen, but just tell them that. You know, all types of tactics. I mean, I'm being broad and I'm being kind of vague because I'm not speaking of specific instances. But when you say overall tactics, I have to, you know, use my empirical understanding of what took place when I was there and what I saw, and try to utilize that as to give you an understanding as to what's taking place in the prisons right now.
Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah. Can you all talk a little bit about the details of the call-in campaign that's going on right now? How can folks look into it and participate?
It is currently on a Facebook page, event page, that I please call to stop Missouri prisoner torture, I believe. People can look it up on the Incarcerated Workers Organizing Committee Facebook page, and then from there they can get to it. And it's also going out over the IWOC email list. And so if people want to email IWOC@riseup.net, then we can get them tied in for sure. And I can't recall the exact wording on the campaign right now. But again, that email is IWOC@riseup.net. And I can get you hooked in with how to call in. And we've got a video off with a sample of how to call prisons for people who haven't done that before. It can be really super scary, and but they don't hurt you. You can call them. And being a concerned citizen, you know, you don't even have to be, you know, radicalized or anything. All you have to do is just care about people and say, I'm a concerned citizen, and this matters to me. And it's really not scary to call them. And they are... really afraid of being brought up on international charges of human rights violations, because what they're doing violates human rights across the board, the Geneva Conventions and just basic human decency. They're torturing people. They have people in solitary confinement long past what is acceptable for a human, and they know that they're doing this. And so these call-ins are really super effective because they know they're doing wrong and they know it's really serious to torture people, So we appreciate anybody that calls in.
And can you all talk about the IWOC and the Missouri Innocence Project? Like, individually talk about the projects that you work with and what sort of work you do outside of this?
Well, with regard to the Innocence Project, you know, I work in conjunction with different projects here in Missouri. And particularly, you know, I got one particular case I'm working on with the Midwest Innocence Project, and we work together on this case. But particularly what the Midwest Innocence Project does, or any Innocence Project for that matter, throughout, you know, the Innocence Projects here in Missouri, but also Innocence Projects in different... Here, there's a five-state region. The Midwest Innocence Project has five-state regions. At any rate, my facts are getting kind of convoluted in my head.
That's no worries.
But they work with other Innocence Projects across the country and throughout, you know, the globe. What they do is screen cases where a prisoner says, hey, look, I didn't do it. You know, I absolutely did not do this. And with an Innocence Project, that's what we're looking for, your innocence. We're not looking for, hey, the court made a mistake or anything of that nature. We're looking for, look, you didn't do this. We know you didn't do it. We're going to prove it and get you out of there. That's basically what an Innocence Project does.
And the Incarcerated Workers Organizing Committee is we're not actually an official committee of the IWW. We're still working on our internal paperwork, which won't mean much to most of your listeners. But we are a group, and we are unionizing prisoners, and at the same time defining what that means. We've opened up the IWW. All prisoners anywhere in the world can join the IWW for free. That free membership extends up to 60 or 90 days after their release. And ideally, we're hoping to build community between inside and outside. And one of the main goals is, of course, to give prisoners voice on the outside, but also to help people coordinate together and address the conditions, you know, nationally or internationally or regionally or however we can, to support the prisoners' actual efforts to improve their own condition.
Is there anything that we didn't talk about in this that would be informative to listeners?
Well, I'm not sure.
Now, if you ask us to open in the thing between Tommy and I, we'll keep you for an hour.
Thank you so much, both of you, for chatting, and good luck.
Thank you very much also for giving people a voice from inside the prisons.
You too.
I couldn't have said it better myself.
Thank you, Tommy. Thank you, Brianna.
She is definitely the voice of these prisoners in Missouri, and we need to thank God that we got people out here like her that dedicate themselves, you know, because we just couldn't do this without people like her to give a voice to what's going on in these prisons and, you know, just how this, I don't know.
That's good. We're done. Okay, thank you so much first.
Yeah, thanks so much. Y'all take care.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye. Now let's close out with a metal track from General Grievous with the song Opresia from their album Oppression. This album was released on May Day of 2015, and the band hails from Nizhny Novgorod in Russia. Thank you. We just listened to a metal track by General Grievous. The song was Opresia from the album Oppression. And the band is from Nizhny Novgorod in Russia. You're listening to Asheville FM at WSFM LP 103.3 Asheville. Also online at ashevillefreemedia.org. This is The Final Straw, and I'm Bursa Goodness. The show can also be heard on KXCF in Marshall, California, KWTF in Bodega Bay, California, KOWALP in Olympia, Washington, and WCRSLP in Columbus, Ohio. Archives of the show can be found a week after broadcast at thefinalstrawradio.noblogs.org, and you can reach us for queries or comments or whatever at thefinalstrawradio@riseup.net. Next up on WSFM LP 103.3 Asheville and ashevillefm.org is Onward Through the Fog, a two-hour journey through the fogginess of music. Each week, host Jake Yonker explores old and new favorites, highlighting various artists, and just enjoying a unique blend of musical genres.